past January, members of the Virginia General Assembly were considering a resolution to apologize for slavery. Delegate Frank Hargrove argued against it, saying, "Instead of seeking a formal apology from the Commonwealth for slavery, black citizens should get over it." Now, it would be easy for me to dismiss Mr. Hargrove's comments as the ramblings of an old white guy. But I know comments like this often arise from fear, hurt, and wound. I'm not trying to defend Mr. Hargrove. I'm just trying to understand why an otherwise decent human being would say something so hateful. And even though he's the one who said it out loud, I know there must be a lot of people who said it silently to themselves. Like all white children who grew up in Virginia during the Jim Crow years, the segregation years, Mr. Hargrove probably has memories of a confusing, conflicted world. Children in that time, as in all times, knew instinctively that they belonged to the world and the world belonged to them. They knew about love, they knew about kindness. Nobody had to teach them that. But as they grew up during the years of forced segregation, adults taught them just the opposite. No, you can't invite that exchange student from Africa over for dinner. No, you cannot play with those white children. Their daddy's the sheriff. Don't touch that water fountain. It's not for us. Mommy, can we ride in the back of the bus? No, it's not for us. As adults pulled their children away from their friends just because of their skin color, children were put into the terrible position of having to choose between what they knew was right and moral and the acceptance of their families, the security of their loved ones. Now, of course, they're children, and so they don't really have a choice, do they? Their survival depended on them going with their people. I bet Mr. Hargrove has memories like that. He was born in 1927, just a year after Virginia passed its Public Assemblage Act, which prohibited people of different races from gathering together in public places. As Mr. Hargrove grew into manhood, he would see more laws passed by the people he looked up to and respected, laws that mandated separation, a separation that the soul of every human being knows to be wrong. As Robert Frost says in his poem, The Mending Wall, "Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down." Good fences do not make good neighbors. The soul, or the deep self, knows of the wound that comes from being separated from others, and thus separated from our fullest human selves. The wounds suffered by our African-American friends and neighbors and family members are fairly obvious, material wounds in the form of economic and political disadvantage, spiritual wounds in the form of internalized messages of inferiority. The wounds suffered by white Americans are not so easy to see. The writer Peggy McIntosh describes this wound as a deadness in life that comes from living out of the story that others are inferior. Now, while most Americans concede that racism has wounded African-American people, the majority do not accept that racism still hurts them today, and they cannot imagine how racism could possibly wound white people. Today's prevailing view of racism in our country goes something like this. During the Civil Rights Movement, good-willed, fair-minded white people picked up their protest signs and marched with Dr. King. They teared down the walls that separated them from their African-American brothers and sisters. Physical barriers fell away. the terrible laws repealed, the signs over the drinking fountains faded. Time passed and healed all wounds. The calendar turns, and a new millennium brings hope. African American leaders take powerful positions in all sectors of society. Young adults are dating outside their race in record numbers, and young children of all shades and hues play together happily. Racism is essentially over. The playing field has been leveled. The bedrock values of this great nation have finally been redeemed. Everyone gets the same opportunity to succeed or fail on their own merits. Now, if this prevailing view is true, then how does one explain that in Williamsburg, 49% of African American youth live below the federal poverty line? Or that 41% of African Americans work in low-paying service jobs, while 41% of whites work in high-paying professional and managerial jobs? How does one explain that while nearly 15% of everyone living in James City County is African American, only 4% of the businesses are minority owned? And last month's minority achievement report from the school system shows yet another year of consistently poor results for black students. Now, I know that most of you in this audience understand these statistics to be a symptom of institutionalized racism. People like Mr. Hargrove, however, will look at these statistics and stand by their story that racism is over. Author Derek Bell observes that today, statistics, complaints, even secretly filmed instances of discrimination that are televised nationwide upset few people, because evidently no amount of hard evidence will shake the nation's conviction that the system is fair for all. What is this power that keeps the conviction so strong? What is at the root of this persistent denial? White Americans have differing views on whether racism has indeed been eliminated, but they do share one idea, that racism is about people of color. It's about their problems, their oppression, their disadvantage, their experiences as black, Hispanic, or Asian. Racism is not about white people. But of course, it is. The concept of race and the creation of white identity rose together. So what does it mean to be white? Is it a matter of physical attributes from European ancestors? Does having European features like the one depicted on the cover of your order of service mean that you're white? One of my earliest memories from elementary school is of a picture book showing the so-called races of man. I remember this book vividly. In the front of the book was a skin color chart that I would constantly put my hand next to. And I wondered why people called me yellow, because I couldn't quite find yellow on this chart. The Mongoloids, which I always thought to be a very ugly sounding word, were pictured as small, sallow-skinned people with tiny eyes. And in my memory, Caucasians were pictured as robust and healthy. Today, it is common knowledge that race has no genetic basis. We really are one human race, because not one characteristic or gene distinguishes all members of one's so-called race. So, if race does not exist as a biological reality, then how did race become such a powerful force in American society? Well, to answer this question, we have to understand that race, as it developed in the United States, is a modern idea. Societies generally did not divide people according to physical difference, but according to things like religion and social and economic class. Such was the situation here in the 17th century. In her book, Learning to be White, the Unitarian Universalist theologian Tandeka asserts that racism and this concept of whiteness as a privileged identity grew out of an economic strategy by the gentry class. And it all started right here in Virginia. During the mid-1600s, poor English servants and African slaves were equally despised as vile and brutish. Servants and slaves, regardless of skin color, worked side by side in the fields, socialized, and in some cases had children together. And most disconcerting to the ruling class, they worked together to rebel against their masters. These intimate bonds among people with natural affinities toward one another became a threat to the ruling class. The gentry used the strength of simple economics to drive a wedge between white servants and black slaves, and they passed new laws that would ensure the permanency of that schism, a schism that we live with today. The cold economic fact back then, basically, was that the useful life of an English indentured servant was short, as he or she would be freed after some years. An African slave, however, represented a useful resource not only for his or her life, but for the life of his or her progeny. In other words, the slave was a better buy than the indentured servant, and the supplies were increasing and prices were dropping. The Virginia Assembly enacted laws that deepened the animosity between African slaves and white servants. They prohibited slaves and servants from keeping company and drinking together. They made it unlawful to whip a naked white servant. They confiscated slave property and livestock, selling them for the benefit of the white poor. And at the same time the assembly took assets from the slaves, they required white indentured servants to be given corn, money, a gun, clothing, and 50 acres of land upon the release of servants. These laws and the bitterness they created led to unnatural segregation of people who were otherwise connected by natural bonds of affinity. And from this deep breach, the white identity was fashioned. From there, a young America rose to its independence, proclaiming universal humanity, equality, justice for all. These values, however, clashed with the reality of chattel slavery. How would they resolve this conflict, this moral conflict? They did it by reinforcing the myth of white superiority and black inferiority through racial purity laws, laws that prevailed well into the 20th century. The first of such laws was passed in Virginia in 1866, and it defined a colored person as having 1/4 or more Negro blood. Over the next 50 years, the percentage of colored persons in Virginia decreased, leading officials to fear that white people and people of color were getting together and having children who were trying to pass as white. In 1912, the General Assembly established a Bureau of Vital Statistics. They kept track of the race of every couple who married and every couple who had children. The first registrar of that bureau was an outspoken racial purity advocate who saw his job as keeping and preserving the purity of the white race. According to Professor Dick Sherman, who's a friend of our congregation, in 1924, Virginia enacted the strictest racial purity law in the entire country, this law defined white people as a person who has no trace whatsoever of any blood other than Caucasian. And if someone challenged your claim to be white, you had the burden to prove that there was no blood, non-white blood, anywhere in your ancestry. An impossible burden. Eventually, that law was changed to eliminate the burden of proof and to classify as white any person with no ascertainable amount of non-white blood. The rhetoric used to get this law passed was extraordinary. One drop of Negro blood makes the Negro. That's what the proponents proclaimed. They also asserted that once a drop of inferior blood gets into a white man's veins, he descends lower and lower into the mongrel scale. The proponents of this law were small in number and certainly deserved to be labeled extremists, but they held positions of power, and they were able to get the racial purity laws passed. And these racial purity laws were then reinforced by Jim Crow laws, including the Public Assemblage Act of 1926 that I mentioned earlier. Interestingly, this law was in direct response to this common practice at that time of blacks and whites socializing together at the Hampton Institute. Its purpose was not segregation, pure and simple, like the one that required separate waiting rooms in hotels and in airports, but rather it was a conscious attempt to eliminate opportunities for social intercourse between blacks and whites for fear that that this would lead to sexual intercourse. Astoundingly, the Public Assemblage Act survived until 1963. The Virginia Racial Purity Law survived until 1967, when it was effectively ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Loving versus Virginia. Even with this Supreme Court ruling, racial purity laws remained on the books in South Carolina until 1998 and in Alabama until the year 2000. And so we come to this time, our time, February 2007, Richmond, Virginia. The Virginia General Assembly passed a resolution to formally express regret for their role in slavery. They are the first state to take this action. The vote was unanimous in both the House and the Senate, and even Mr. Hargrove finally gave in. This is a very good step. It's a very good first step toward eliminating racism, because we still must make remedies for African Americans. But racism will never go away until there is an equal effort to transcend the construction of white identity. Perhaps then the state should apologize for perpetuating the myth of racial separation, for drawing false lines between neighbors and neighborhoods, for preventing citizens from being friends, for separating lovers, for creating a story that it's normal for whites to never have intimate relations with African Americans, for burying the truth that white identity is not a biological fact, but a social construct, and for pushing the lie that we are inherently different, that we are opposite. Human beings can dismantle racism because human beings created racism. But it's going to require telling the truth about the formation of white identity, that it was created for the material advancement for just a few people at terrible cost to all people. It's going to require telling the truth about the hidden wounds and silent hurt that comes from being separated from our full humanity. This is our work, to speak the truth. This is our work, to change the world with our love. May it be so. Amen.